Thank you, you may all have a seat. All right, this next case is called Joyce Nino, which is Marilyn Watts. May I have the entry of appearances, please?
Jennifer Davis, 02572.
Ms. Davis, thank you.
Robert McGuire, 37124.
Okay, counsel. Counsel, this case is set for 1 hour. That means that each of you get a half an hour. And in your case, Ms. Davis, it means that you need to keep track of your time if you want to reserve anything in terms of rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, Ms. Davis, please go ahead.
The issue today is whether attorney's fees may be imposed.
Ms. Davis, can I ask you a favor? Can you pull the microphone?
Oh, sure.
I want to make sure we can hear you. There we go. Thank you. Sorry.
Is whether attorney's fees may be imposed under CRS 2472-2046A, which I'll refer to as Section 6A, even though that section does not expressly provide for an award of attorney's fees. This case was brought by the clerk under Section 6A, not under Section 5, but was resolved by mutual agreement of parties after a change in the law. There was never a hearing on the merits in this case, and there was never a court order requiring the county to comply with Newmark's four requests. When considering an award of attorney's fees, the primary point of reference is the American rule, where each litigant pays her own attorney's fees, win or lose, unless the statute or contract provides otherwise. Section 6A does not expressly provide for an award of attorney's fees. The Court of Appeals decision acknowledges that. Thus, any imposition of fees would effectively overrule application of the American rule. The American rule for more than 200 years has been recognized by the courts in this country, including Colorado, and they have based their consideration of attorney's fees on the American rule. The reason for this lies in notions of freedom and equal access to justice. The U.S. acknowledged that the American rule in 1796, in a case involving maritime law entitled Arkham Campbell v. Wesson. In that case, the Circuit Court of Rhode Island had awarded damages in a charge of $1,600 in attorney's fees against the losing party. On appeal, the court simply rejected that charge of attorney's fees, stating we do not think the charge ought to be allowed. The general practice of the United States is in opposition to it, and that practice that was referred to by the U.S. Supreme Court, which is still followed today, derives from American colonists' quest for freedom from British opposition. When the colonists secured their independence, they became allowed equal access to the courts to vindicate the rights accruing from self-governance. Litigation is uncertain, and American courts were reluctant to penalize someone for merely defending or prosecuting a lawsuit by imposing attorney's fees if they lose. Colorado has also recognized these concepts and has long recognized the American rule. As stated by this court in the 1996 case of Bernhardt v. Farmers Exchange, four litigants may be discouraged from instituting actions to vindicate their rights if the penalty for losing is including paying their opponent's attorney's fees. Plus, requiring courts to ascertain the reasonableness of attorney's fees in every case puts a substantial burden on the courts.
Ms. Davis, can I interrupt you? Can I jump to sort of what I think is my biggest curiosity is, why in Section 6 does it refer to attorney's fees at all?
That section is a safe harbor. Nothing in the language of that section imposes attorney's fees. Rather, it states that the attorney's fees that are mandatory under Section 5 do not apply in certain circumstances. Now, I'll grant that those circumstances aren't present in this case because the trial court has found that Clerk Reno was filing under the quest to find that the disclosure of the documents would cause substantial injury to the public interest, and the county did not appeal that finding. However, that does not, a mention of attorney's fees that provides a safe harbor does not amount to specific and clear language imposing attorney's fees, and that's really the standard that was imposed by this court in Mr. Rainey case. There must be specific and clear language. So the reason why you need an safe harbor in that section would be there's nothing that would have precluded Ms. Marks from filing under Section 5 while this case was going on.
So only in light of if there was a counterclaim under that?
If there was a counterclaim or if there were two cases going on, and what has happened in a number of cases, including cases that Ms. Marks has brought, there would be a filing under both Section 5 and under subsection 6, and it would consolidate those claims. So in those cases, a custodian, a reference custodian, would be protected if there was a finding that the record needs to be disclosed, but the custodian had brought the case in good faith.
All right, thank you.
And so under your reading, then, if the clerk proceeds under 6A under the other provision, in other words, the provision seeking an order from the court prohibiting or restricting disclosure, by taking that action, the clerk is, in every case, immunized from fees, no matter how that determination comes out?
Absolutely not. Well, I suppose if the records requester has never filed under subsection 5, then yes, there is nothing in subsection 6 that awards attorney's fees to a prevailing applicant. And this position is justified by the legislative history. If you look at the legislative history behind House Bill 01-1359, which is the provision for the legislation that initially made attorney's fees mandatory under subsection 5. That legislative history consistently refers to attorney's fees being available to one who brings the action. And I've cited that specific language in my brief, that it's clear that someone, the records requester, needs to actually bring an action before attorney's fees to be imposed. The other thing to note is if you look at the language in subsection 5, there is, but right before it talks about the mandatory award for attorney's fees, it mentions, let me just turn to the section. It states first that there, a hearing on such application shall be held at the earliest practical time. Unless the court finds that denial of the right of inspection was proper, it shall order the custodian to permit inspection and award costs and reasonable attorney's fees. That's in Section 5. But what it's requiring is that there be a hearing on the merits of the claim before there can be an award of attorney's fees. So I guess there's two things that would have to happen in this case that would have had to have happened for attorney's fees to be appropriate. Number one, there needed to be either a counterclaim or something that made Ms. Marks an actual party to litigation. At this point, they are seeking attorney's fees even though they are not a party.
Did they respond? Did she respond?
She did not enter appearance. She did file a motion for summary judgment. And if you look at the language of Section 6, it does state that a records requester may appear, but it does not bring them into party status. So they are required to appear. The trial court will be doing in a subsection 6 proceeding is making a determination, in our case, of whether disclosure of the requested records would do substantial injury to the public interest. And they can make that determination whether or not the records requester appears. If Ms. Marks wanted to become a party to the litigation, she could have filed a counterclaim, she could have filed an answer. Neither of those appeared. She never made any sort of filing like that, never really entered an appearance in the case, although the only hearing that was held on the case was a hearing simply on whether attorney's fees would be appropriate.
I'm just trying to understand. So you would have to say when the clerk brings an action under Section 6, the only way a requestor could ever obtain attorney's fees is if the requestor either simultaneously files a separate action under 5, Section 5, or at least the minimum files a counterclaim in the clerk's action under Section 5.
Yes, or could later bring a Section 5 claim. I don't know that they would have to do it simultaneously. There was some language in the briefs talking about, well, why does it matter who files first? And I don't think it does. In our case, you know, we filed under Subsection 6. Ms. Marks could have come, you know, a month later and filed under Subsection 5 and been awarded attorney's fees under that section if there had been a hearing on the merits. But absent that, when you look at the legislative history to House Bill 01-1359, all of the testimony talks about the that attorney's fees are available to one who brings an action. And if you also look at the language that this court set out when it decided the recent Penfield decision, it talks about attorney's fees being mandatory in connection with a CORA request, and there's two things that need to happen. Someone applies for, and the only way they can apply for a court order is under subsection 5. So they need to apply for an order, and number two, they need to receive a court order requiring the custodian to permit inspection, and neither of those elements were present in this case.
So in section 6, the language that says, the attorney's fees provision shall not apply in cases, et cetera, you would not always draw the inference that section 5 attorney's fees provisions does apply to all other section 6 actions. I'm sorry, I didn't think it was up for real. Did you get the gist of my statement there?
Yes. Okay. I have a little trouble following the Court of Appeals decision, but I think that's what they base their decision on is there's an that language implies that attorney's fees are available under subsection 6. However, once again, I think that rationale, first of all, runs counter to the directive in Cervani that requires that any award or fee shifting has to be specific and clear. And I don't see how you can take that language that provides for safe harbor and say that that specifically and clearly allows for an award of an attorney's fee of attorney's fees to someone who did not make an application under subsection 5.
So in your mind, surveying would require affirmative language in section 6 saying that attorney's fees are likewise available in a section 6 action in the following circumstances.
Exactly, and they have that language in subsection 5. So that language is there in subsection 5, and that's the type of language that at least I was looking for when I was advising my client as to whether there was a risk of attorney's fees under subsection 6. There was simply nothing that said that attorney's fees may be awarded if you don't reach a or obtain a court ruling that it was proper to withhold the documents. And there is a complete absence of that language. And again, when you look at what subsection 6 looked like prior to there being a addition of a mandatory fee language in subsection
5. There's nothing in
there. I'm sorry?
In the prior version, there was nothing in there about attorney's fees, period, right?
That's right. And so it was added to subsection 5 in 2001 to make it mandatory. And I think what's interesting about that process is that the at that time when they wanted to make the attorney's fees mandatory in subsection 5 action, reading through the legislative history, you'll see that the local governments were concerned about having a fee award if they, in good faith, did not know whether or not they should disclose the document or not. And that's what prompted that whole clause in subsection 6.
Which means a judicial determination?
I'm sorry?
Which means a judicial determination?
I'm not sure.
The trigger is a lawsuit and a judicial determination or a settlement?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, the trigger has to be that they have to file under subsection 5. I'm not sure if I'm answering
the
question.
Please go ahead.
They have to file under subsection 5, and then there has to be a hearing on the merits.
Okay.
And once you have those two elements, then an attorney's fees award is appropriate. But the compromise language, which is that safe harbor in subsection 6, was added in order to provide a protection to local governments, and the legislative history makes that clear. There's nothing in the legislative history when they were adding the mandatory language to subsection 5 that indicates that there was any intent to start imposing attorney's fees under 6A. Absolutely nothing in it.
As a matter of just the way it works out, what really is the difference between a local government person taking the position of safe harbor and filing something and saying, I have to turn over the documents for this reason? I understand that it's
different. There's two different ways you can, a local government can file, or two different claims they can make. One is making a claim that disclosure of the documents, we believe that this record may have to be turned over under CORA. However, we believe that if we turned it over, it would do substantial injury to the public interest. That's one way. And the safe harbor doesn't address that. The second is if they truly do not know whether or not you're required to turn it over. And that's what I think the safe harbor gives them, a safe harbor too. The trial court referred to that circumstance as the reasonable uncertainty provision, whereas the first one they referred to as the denial provision. Now, we attempted to argue both at the trial court level. The trial court found that we filed exclusively under the denial provision, and we did not appeal that finding. My rationale in appealing that, not appealing that finding, was that I didn't see, because there had never been a Section 5 filing, that there was no exposure to attorney's fees anyway. So to me, it wouldn't have mattered. I think the other indication, besides that I mentioned the references in the legislative history to attorney's fees being available to someone who applies, to a record requester who applies and receives a court order. The other thing to note in the legislative history is it sort of augments the importance of a provision in subsection 5 that talks about before attorney's fees are going to be awarded, and this again is a protection that was given to local governments in House Bill 01-1359, the records requester has to give 3 days notice to the custodian that they are going to file under Section 5 and they're going to seek attorney's fees. Now, in this case, Ms. Marks did give that 3 days notice, but if the Court of Appeals ruling is upheld, you wouldn't necessarily receive that 3 days notice. What the Court of Appeals decision is saying is that they would impose attorney's fees under subsection 6, even if the records requester never became a party and never made that 3 days notice. If you have a situation like ours, absent a indication that there's that 3 days notice, attorney's fees arguably could be awarded without that notice of return, without putting the government on alert that they're at risk of attorney's fees. And that was something, again, that as you read through those excerpts in the legislative history, that is a protection to the local governments.
Counsel, before you move on, can I just get you to respond? And this is, I guess, a variation of the Chief's question, which is, I think your opposing counsel will argue that Ms. Marks is the functional equivalent of a party, basically. She was acting like a party or an applicant. And essentially, your argument is elevating kind of a form over substance idea. And I'm wondering, could you respond to that?
Yes, and I can see that there is an appearance of form over substance. And as was asked earlier, you know, all she had to do is my position that all she had to do was file under subsection 5 or file a counterclaim. But yes, I think that is an important element, because that what that does is now alerts the governments that we are now at risk of attorney's fees. It might have very well changed our strategy and how we proceeded in this case. But I'd also stress that it's not just filing under subsection 5. You also have to have a hearing on the merits in order to get attorney's fees. So let's say in this case, she did file under subsection 5. I would still argue that she would not be entitled to attorney's fees because the disclosure occurred after a change in the law and not because of any court order saying county needs to disclose these documents. So those two elements have to be met. Surveying requires there to be specific and clear language in order to overcome the American rules mandate that each party bear their own costs, and that specific and clear language does not appear.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You may, certainly. All right, Mr. McGuire.
Hey, police court. My name is Robert McGuire. I represent the appellee, Marilyn Marks, who is the appellant in the Court of Appeals and the respondent in the district court. The court today is called upon to decide which of two textually plausible interpretations of the fee shifting provision in subsection 6 should apply. I say that they're both textually plausible in the sense that you can rationally take the position that the clerk is taking, or you can rationally take the position that Ms. Marks is taking with respect to what that fee shifting language means. But only one of those interpretations is reasonable in the context of what a court tries to do as a statute. So I hope to cover is first, I'd like to show that Ms. Marks' interpretation is the reasonable one. Second, that Clerk Reno's interpretation is unreasonable. And third, explain how in this case Ms. Marks did everything possible to minimize costs. And that's relevant because one of the issues that was raised is that there wasn't an order by the court. And part of the reason why it wasn't is because Ms. Marks did everything she could to minimize costs. In Benefield, this court just 9 months ago said the court is clearly structured to provide disincentives to forcing an applicant to vindicate his right of inspection by filing with the district court and encouragement for resolution of the matter otherwise. This court also noted that a 3-day notice period gives the custodian opportunity to reconsider his denial with an awareness that his initial decision will be challenged in court. And finally, I think the last sentence of the court in the field does seem to implicitly assume that fees would apply in subsection 2046 actions. In this case, Ms. Marks gave notice. She told the clerk that she was going to go to court under subsection 5 to vindicate her rights. The clerk, rather than take that opportunity to reconsider the validity of withholding the records that were issued, took Ms. Marks to court, served her, and essentially initiated this litigation in which Ms. Marks, if she wanted to vindicate her right to inspect the records at issue, had to appear and make an argument. Now, under these facts, Ms. Marks' argument is that subsection 2046 requires that if the clerk does not obtain a finding that the record is properly denied, inspection of the record is properly denied, 2046 mandates that there be an attorney fee award using the standard that is supplied by subsection 2045. And that is a conclusion that is pretty much taken as the straight implication of the language in 2046. 2046 says the attorney fees provision of subsection 2045, I'll paraphrase slightly, shall not apply in cases brought pursuant to paragraph A of 2046 by an official custodian who is unable to determine disclosure of the evidence proof, and there's some other things that the custodian has to prove. That exception would not be necessary at all if the language of 2045 shifting fees didn't apply in actions brought under 2046. And to the extent that Clerk Reno's position is that that language is included in 2046 to protect custodians against counterclaims brought under 2045. The more natural place for that language to be included would be under 2045 rather than under 2046. So Ms. Marks' interpretation of 2046 is reasonable based on the language of 2046, because the language of 2046 creates a carve-out which implies a rule of general application, and that rule of general application is that fee shifting applies in 2046 cases. Now, the reason this is reasonable is because it aligns with what this court said in Benefit. In Benefit, we looked at 2045, and this court ruled that under 2045, court is structured to discourage custodians from making people vindicate their rights in court. That's what the 3-day notice period is. That's what the asymmetrical fee shifting is provided for under 2045. And the 3-day notice period, this court said, was placed in the court to give custodians a chance to reconsider their denial decision. And upon reconsidering their denial decision, if the custodian still forces a person to go to court to review fee shifting, if the custodian fails to obtain an order. So if you take that analysis of 2045 and you juxtapose it with the language in 2046, Ms. Marks' interpretation of 2046 is perfectly consistent. The reason it's perfectly consistent is because the custodian's incentives under both provisions are the same. Under 2045, the custodian has an incentive not to make you take them to court. Under 2046, the custodian has no incentive to take you to court unless they think they're going to be right. Because if they are right, then you're still going to have to pay your fees. This brings me to the second point, which is why the clerk's interpretation is unreasonable. And the reason it's unreasonable is it takes the exact opposite viewpoint on 2046. Rather than viewing the fee shifting of 2045 as applying in a 2046 case, the custodian's interpretation would effectively immunize custodians from any fee shifting if they won the race to the courthouse, even if they're wrong. And that, what that does is it takes the 3-day sort of pause that the records requester has to go through before they can go to court, and it turns it into basically an uneven starting point. The custodian is always going to win the race to the courthouse once they get the 3-day notice, because they're going to have 3 days to file their case. And once they do that, they're going to be immunized against fee claims even if they're wrong. Whereas if they had waited to be sued, if they're wrong, they're going to have to pay the other side's fees. So the custodian's interpretation is unreasonable.
Well, let me interrupt there. If they file and they lose, in other words, there's an order against them, then the requester is certainly a prevailing party and would be entitled to fees, right? So I think you're drawing that analogy a little too broadly.
I believe their interpretation is that unless there's a 2045 claim,
but they were riding two horses. One, that she's not a party to, that she didn't prevail. But if there were to be a hearing, maybe Ms. Davis will be able to help us with this. But if there were to be a hearing, and there would have to be a hearing if there was not a settlement, the court couldn't rule on this or shouldn't rule on this absent some kind of a hearing. And then there would be a decision. There would be a prevailing party, right? And then there would be attorney's fees.
Yes, I think there are two issues in that question.
Sure.
And the first is, so if a person is taken to court by a custodian and they don't file their own counterclaim or their own case that they didn't consolidate, so they're just taken to court and they're passive, and they appear and they argue through counsel or pro se, then I believe under their theory, even if there's a hearing on the merits, even if the person wins, there's no fee shifting because under their theory, 2046 doesn't provide for fee shifting. Now, we would disagree with that because we think the exclusion, the carve-out, implies that there is fee shifting. So the second question then is a hearing on the merits required? And a hearing on the merits is in the best interest of the custodian who brings the case in good faith, because the language of 2045, court has got lots of ambiguous elements. But in 2045, one part that is not ambiguous, that is very clear in some language, is that unless there is a finding that says that disclosure of the record is prohibited, unless there is a finding, a further finding, then fee shifting in favor of the records requester applies. That's what it says in 2045. So if that provision applies in 2046, then unless you are going to re-engineer it based on the fact that it's in different contexts, the fact that there is no hearing hurts the custodian because the custodian took this person to court and didn't obtain the finding they need to prevent fee shifting from treating. So I think, I hope I answered your question, but I think the two issues there are, under their theory, I don't believe that however it comes out on the merits matters, because under their theory, unless Ms. Marks had brought over a claim, she'd never be able to get fees.
Let me ask you one more question, because maybe I'm confused. Ms. Marks filed a motion for summary judgment.
It's a Rule 12C motion.
All right, a motion under the rules. She was allowed to do so as what the opponent, she also was served.
She was served as she was required to be served.
Right.
We waived service, and I take counsel's word for it that I may not have, but I did certainly appear when I filed the Rule 12C motion. There was certainly, Ms. Marks was involved actively in the litigation. We took the position that we were a party. There was some sort of crosstalk in the briefing as to whether we were actually a party, but the trial court treated us as a party every step of the way.
And then the legislature resolved the issue, so to speak. The case went away without any subsequent kind of an order except for attorney's fees. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, our position is that the legislature didn't change anything. Our position, this case was brought, the court request that gave rise to this case was intent by Ms. Marks to apply the decision in the Court of Appeals in a case called Morris v. Cook, which essentially held that digital scans of voter ballots were public records and people could inspect them. That came down on September 29th, 2011. Ms. Marks then made this request about a week and a half later in Chaffee County to inspect voting ballots because once the case was handed down, she wanted to make sure people knew about it and begin to use it. Ms. Marks is an election integrity activist, and part of what she does is help verify elections. So she made this request based on Marks v. Cook, which was an appellate decision that was published. It was valid precedent, that is a limited issue. And party that Ms. Marks was taken to court by Clerk Reno. The ballots were never turned over. At some point during the following session, the legislative session, it became clear that there was an effort in the legislature to essentially address the issue of whether ballots were, in fact, subject to inspection in court. There was a Senate bill that Senator Heath was putting together that initially, at least in working group sessions, was initially designed to essentially say that ballots weren't subject to inspection in the court. That isn't what actually happened. That isn't what wound up passing. But Ms. Marsh was part of that working group. She was aware that there was a legislative effort to essentially take this right away. And that was the time when Clerk Reno approached Ms. Marsh and said, let's hold this case in advance until we know what happens in the legislature. And because Ms. Marsh every step of the way was doing what she could to minimize costs, she agreed to do that. It turned out that when House Bill 12-1036 was enacted, the Senate bill died and the session was terminated over the civil unions fracas, and it was revived in a special session as House Bill 1036. There was a complete insertion into a House bill as a sort of vehicle. And so it became law. But it did not prohibit the inspection of ballots. Instead, it created some blackout periods around elections when ballots couldn't be, you didn't have to honor a court request to inspect ballots. And so it didn't change the law that had already existed when this case began, which was that ballots were subject to public inspection. And so once that became law, the parties got back together. I think at that point, Clerk Reno, I won't speak for her, but my impression being on the other side of it was that at that point, Clerk Reno, the expectations that this bill would prohibit ballot inspections had not come out. At that point, she knew that her case was initially going to fail. And so then she offered to provide us with a ballot and in exchange for dropping the case. And at that point, Ms. Marks had invested fees in defending her position and said that she was happy to allow Clerk Reno to withdraw from the case, provided that her fee claim was reserved. And that's what and said he may have a status conference with the district court judge on June 22nd. He basically okayed that, and so the ballot was subsequently provided, and then we went to a hearing. And the hearing was not so much Ms. Marks' motion for fees. It was a hearing done at Pergrino's instigation in order to show that she had in good faith not known whether ballots were a subject of inspection, which was a change in position from what she pled, because we shouldn't plead that in her complaint. And interestingly, at the September 27th, I believe it was, 2012 hearing on whether she had acted in good faith, Pergrino actually took the position that subsection 2046 does apply fee shifting under 2045. She admitted to the trial court, and it's in the record at 334, line 14, 335, line 1. She admitted basically that the fee shifting 2045 does apply in 2046 unless she's able to show that she's uncertain. And so her position has changed.
So you say at that point she was arguing what was tantamount to a safe harbor kind of argument?
Yes.
But that she hadn't done so in the initial pleading?
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
And in fact, she'd done the opposite. She had argued affirmatively in the pleading that disclosure of voting ballots was prohibited for several reasons. And as the Court of Appeals in Benfield held, you can't, on the one hand, assert the safe harbor based on uncertainty, on one hand, and on the other hand, say that, well, disclosure is prohibited for all of these reasons, because they're basically trying to do two things at once. They're trying to have your cake and eat it too. And so the trial court ruled that she actually did not act. She wasn't eligible for the safe harbor. And so since then, her position is now shifting, and now she
did. But the trial court went ahead and said she didn't proceed under safe harbor, but she did not have to be attorney's fees. Ms. Marks was not an attorney's fees.
Correct. The reason the trial court held as it did was because the trial court essentially the trial court injected the theory that's now in dispute before this court, which is the trial court reasoned that 2046 provides a safe harbor, but only against 2045 claims. And there was no 2045 claim. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the trial court reasoned there was nothing in 2046 that expressly authorized the award of fees.
Could I ask you, I get confused about 5 and 6 here and the timing of all this. So in terms of the relations of these two, is it? Do you understand this sequence, the way the rules set it up, that there could be an action under 5 and yet still the custodian could ask for this court determination under 6?
Yes, and my understanding of it, and based on the practice I've seen, is that the two really operate independently, because there's a lot of uncertainty out there among core practitioners. What you get is kind of a mixture of approaches. So as the counsel noted, Ms. Marks has taken different approaches in other cases. She was sued by two custodians on August 19th, 2011, Mesa County and Jefferson County, over electronic ballots under 2046. And in those cases, Ms. Marks separately filed her own 2045 action, moved in each of the two cases to consolidate, and actually additionally moved to consolidate the two separate cases through the multi-district litigation panel. And that was a toss that didn't happen. But Ms. Marks did bring a 2045 claim separately in those cases. But in the course of doing that, of course, it's expensive. And when you're a member of the public, you're being sued by the government, you want to minimize costs. And so then she sued about 2 months later by Pergrino. She made the decision that the law does not require me to do this because 2046 provides species. And that's how they went up here.
Is it your interpretation then of the key language in 6 that you were talking about? The attorney's fees provision of subsection 5 shall not apply in cases brought pursuant to this paragraph A. Then, even if the custodian were to file an action for clarification under 6 after an action had been brought by an applicant under 5, that 6 could not provide any safe harbor for those attorney's fees that would be due under the 5 claim?
I think it would depend on whether the actions were consolidated. If they proceeded as separate actions, you're allowed to bring any defense that you have available under 6 in the action under 5.
But 6, it seems to me, and I guess that's the point I'm asking, is your interpretation of 6 that it only provides a safe harbor from attorney's fees that would be allowed under the 5 provision in a 6 claim, but not in the 5 claim itself?
I'm sorry, yes, I think I misunderstood where you were going with that. But yes, I think the safe harbor is in 6 is limited to actions brought under 6. And that makes sense because that's consistent with the way the statute is structured. It's intended not to, if a custodian is uncertain about what the law requires, they should go to court and get clarification under 6. And at that point, if they go under 6 and they do it properly, then they're not going to be arguing that the records are prohibited from disclosure. They're not going to be taking an adversarial position that compels the records requester to have to hire counsel and defend their own position. And we pointed this out in the trial, but Ms. Sparks has been sued many times in the court, 7 times. And one of those, the Secretary of State sued her and sued her under 6 and provided a complaint that was the model of what a 2046 complaint should look like. It laid out Ms. Marks' position and the alternative position, and it took no position and said we'd like guidance from the court. That's what a 2046 claim should look like. Because in that case, Ms. Marks wouldn't have needed counsel, I think, unless she wanted to have, because she wouldn't have needed to advocate against the government attorney. She would have simply waited like the government attorney for the court to decide.
So apart from the specific language, it's really your construction of the scheme that the intention of the legislature was for the custodian to have to seek clarification before forcing the applicant to file a 5 claim. Once the custodian has forced the applicant to file a 5 claim, she has no safe harbor from paying attorney's fees.
It's certainly under 5.
Under 5.
But there's another sort of circumstance in which the custodian would file a 6 claim and would be liable for fees, and that would be where the record is allowed to be inspected. But in the custodian's opinion, in this particular case, it would harm the public interest to let it be inspected.
Right.
And so the reason it makes sense to shift fees in that situation is because you're taking a right of the public to inspect a record that is conceivably there. They can inspect it. And the custodian is substituting their judgment about whether this particular record should be released. And if they're wrong, and they force the person to litigate to defend their position to get that record, then it makes sense that there would be fee shifting there. The purpose of CORA is to disincentivize custodians from dragging people into court. And so if they know that there's fee shifting, if they're wrong, they're going to be very careful about making decisions to withhold records or to take people to court. And that furthers the public policy of the statute, which is to enhance the ability to inspect public records.
Mr. McGuire, can I factually ask you, you say that Ms. Marks has been sued. What was the caption of the complaint?
So usually, it varies, but usually it's in read a CORA request of Marilyn Marks. And
even in this case, what was the caption?
I think it was in this case as well. I think it was in read a CORA request of Marilyn Marks.
Okay, and then is she served with the complaint?
Yes, she's required to serve with the complaint under 2046 because she has the right to appear and be heard. And so she has to be served. And in this case, the complaint was filed, was served out kind of 10 or 11 days later. I waived service, they contacted me and I waived service. So that's how it was initiated.
Okay, and then let me follow up with, originally what was she asking for when she did her initial CORA request?
So there were initially two requests. The first request was for her to come in and inspect some voting ballots from the previous election. And the clerk responded that was unduly burdensome. There's an election coming up, it's gonna be a pain. And so Ms. Marks, she didn't formally withdraw that request. She didn't say that request was no longer operative, but she said, okay, instead, how about I just look at one ballot, the first one in the first box, that's anonymous.
And is that what the complaint then ultimately was filed on, was the request for that one ballot in the one box?
The complaint was both for a request. Throughout the litigation, and when it came time for the clerk to withdraw her claims, it seemed like it had collapsed into only one thing, as we even talked about, which was the ballot. If you look at the June 22nd status conference transcript, there are numerous references. I myself in that transcript referred to that request for a single ballot as the operative request. And there was no objection by anyone that there were some larger request pending, although that's the position that's being taken out. I will say it doesn't really matter because the law applies equally to both requests. Clerk Menino hasn't obtained an order for finding that those records, that either of the requests should be prohibited.
But in this case, there's been no order issued either way, right? It was just settled.
My hesitation is only whether I'm willing to adopt the word settled.
Resolved.
It was resolved, yes. Clerk Menino produced the ballot, which is the objective that Ms. Marks sought from litigation, although Clerk Menino initiated it. But Ms. Marks had given notice that she was going to go to court to obtain it.
But there was no order ever entered. How does that impact this?
Well, I think it impacts it negatively for the clerk because the burden of proof in court is whether under 2045 or 2046 is on the clerk. And so by definition, if there is no order obtained, then the clerk has not met the burden. And so the other party, because the burden is on one party, if they don't meet that burden, the other party necessarily, in our view, has prevailed. And so there's that sort of linguistic analysis. But then there's the additional analysis, which is that the record is actually produced to us in conjunction with the June phone call of the court, in which we told the court we were willing to allow the merits issues to not go forward, provided we were able to reserve as much as due claim for her fees today. And it was on that basis that the district court judge said, that's my understanding. We're going to have a hearing on the fee issue.
All right. Thank you.
Can I pick up at that juncture? As I understand your argument, your point is that the fee shifting provision in 2045 would necessarily apply in the Section 6 provision unless the safe harbor exception that you've identified, which doesn't apply here. But looking back at the text of Section 5 and the sort of standard under which fees are actually awarded, assuming you can say that it does transfer, it seems to tether fees are awarded on whether the court has found the denial of the right of inspection was proper. Right? So unless the court finds that the denial of the right of inspection was improper, it shall order inspection and award attorney fees to appeal on applicant. I guess I'm looking at the order that was issued here by the judge, and it seems to me that he all but found that the clerk's denial of the request was in fact proper. He doesn't use those magic words, but he says things like, the court finds on the facts before it that the filing of the petition by the clerk was reasonable and necessary because the clerk could not consistent with Colorado law comply with Hicks Marks' demands, and then also says it was not unreasonable for the clerk to deny Ms. Marks' request. Are you recognizing that doesn't flat out say denial is proper? Why isn't that essentially the functional equivalent?
So I would characterize that a piece of the district court opinion as being alternate grounds because he essentially rested his holding on how he read 2046. But then he said, to the extent that I'm wrong, here are other reasons why I wouldn't
deny fees.
Why I would deny fees. I appreciate that he seems to be saying something favorable to the clerk, but what he's very clearly saying is that it is proper for the clerk to come to court under 2046. I think you have to contrast what he says sort of amorphously on that topic with the very clear statement that there has been no finding on the merits for either party. He clearly says that. And what that means is that he did not find for the clerk, and he did not find the denial of inspection as proper. So even though he is sympathetic to the clerk's position, I think you have to view what he says there, the text you're referring to in the context of. He says specifically there's no finding on the merits for either party, and he says specifically that she didn't come to court under the uncertainty provision. And so I feel like if you read that, he's sympathetic to her, he's sympathetic to the the difficulty she faces, and he's sort of enunciating that. But as far as knowledge and holding, he doesn't say that he has to say to exempt her from the fee shifter.
Would you agree then, at least in the Section 6 context, that the standard is whether the trial court finds that the denial is proper, and absent such a finding, the requester is ultimately entitled to fees? Is that the fulcrum there? Or is it simply that Ms. Marks ultimately obtained a record, and in that sense, she was a prevailing applicant? I'm trying to figure out what standard you would have us apply.
I'm arguing for a standard which is very favorable to the requester, which is that once you are taken to court, the custodian is responsible for what the fees you incur unless they obtain a finding on the merits that was proper to withhold the record. So
unless the clerk is a...
Unless the custodian. Yes, unless... So if the custodian...
So how is that textually based, though? I don't see how that...
Well, I mean, that's what 2045 imposes in a case brought by the requester. It says unless the court finds that the denial is proper, it shall order the custodian to permit inspection and shall award costs and fees. So if that's what 2045 says, then that's what transfers to 2046 if fee shifting under 2045 applies in 2046 cases. So what that means is that the custodian in a 2046 case, when they bring you to court, they have assumed the responsibility to obtain a finding in their favor. Otherwise, they are on the hook for the fees that you've incurred as a result of being taken to court.
So when you say a finding in their favor, in other words, a finding that the denial was in fact proper?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. And just to
yeah, Tom, sorry.
Okay. Yes. I'm realizing out of time.
Yes.
We respectfully ask that the decision of the Court of Appeals be affirmed.
Thank you. Ms. Davis.
I want to first just touch on your inquiry about the clerk's position on subsection 6, and our position is that it does not provide for an award for attorney's fees at all. And that's what, getting back to the whole basis.
And that's because?
That's because there's no explicit, there's no specific and clear mention of an award of attorney's fees under subsection 6. Mr. McGuire mentioned the word implicitly quite a bit in his argument. Again, I believe that runs counter to the established precedent in this court, that it's not about whether there's an implicit indication. And in fact, there's nothing in the legislation, the legislative history rather, that supports any sort of implicit indication that attorney's fees are warranted under subsection 6. I did want to touch on something else that was said.
So if this case had not been resolved and a district judge had made a finding under subsection 6 and Ms. Marks won, are you saying that she would still not get attorney's fees?
In this case, our position is that had there not been a filing under subsection 5 and we went to a proceeding on the merits and there was a finding that the records should have been disclosed, she would not have been entitled to attorney's fees because there is nothing in Section 6A that allows for attorney's fees.
So let me just make a positive on understanding. So if it comes under Section 5 and it's not safe harbor, there would be the possibility of attorney's fees.
There would, after
if it's under Section 6, there is, irrespective of the outcome, no possibility of attorney's fees.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Could I follow up this on a closely related point, I think, but if you dwell on the language your opponent emphasizes, which is when it says there'll be no provision or the attorney's fees provision under Section 5 of the section shall not apply, and then it says in cases brought pursuant to this paragraph A. I thought the thrust of your argument initially and in briefs was, well, even there is no provision for attorney's fees here, even though the way it's phrased is, you know, there'll be no provision for the attorney's fees if because it wouldn't be meaningless to say that, because it still has to do with attorney's fees under subsection 5. But your opponent says because of that additional language, it doesn't have to do with attorney's fees under subsection 5, only under 6, in which case I take it the step is that it would be meaningless to put this if language in there unless what it meant was otherwise there will be attorney's fees.
Right, and we disagree with that position. I believe that the purpose of the safe harbor is to protect a records custodian under a subsection 5 case, and I believe that that position is supported by the legislative history. That's exactly what the compromise was about. It might have been an artful drafting that they put the safe harbor in subsection 6, but in some ways it was also a convenient place to put that safe harbor. If you look at section 6B, it talks about in defense of any application for an order under subsection 5, the custodian may raise an issue that's been raised by the custodian in an application under paragraph A of the subsection 6. So it does contemplate that the defenses in subsection 6 would be raised in the subsection 5 action. So, you know, that coupled with the legislative history, as well as language in Benfield, where this court interpreted that safe harbor and said that this safe harbor applies to actions brought into subsection 5.
Do you think that language in cases brought pursuant to this paragraph A by an official custodian can have some meaning, or was that just a mistake? It would seem, your opponent's argument, I guess, as I understand it, is that indicates it's talking about actions. It seems to say right out it's talking about actions under this paragraph A. And I'm looking at the sentence that says, the rest of the sentence that says, the attorney's fees provision of subsection 5 of this section shall not apply, but then it follows up with, in cases brought pursuant to this paragraph A.
I think I see your point, but again, there's a possibility that a case has been brought under subsection A by a custodian, records requester then brings a counterclaim or separate case under section 5. And so I think it's trying to say that if the custodian has brought the reasonable uncertainty provision argument in their filing under subsection A, then attorney's fees wouldn't apply in subsection 5 filing.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Davis, can I follow up on that? Under that reading, doesn't it incentivize the filing of the counterclaim? I mean, if a 6A is already filed, other than the attorney's fees, what's the motive in filing a counterclaim under 5?
To obtain fees. I could also see, and I think this was talked about in the briefs, a concern that a clerk is bringing an action for unscrupulous reasons in order to delay the case, which could also be an explanation for some of the judges' rulings at the trial court level to make the point that this was not a case of a clerk bringing an action to delay.
I don't find that the overall purpose of CORA is to incentivize litigation, correct?
Right.
But I mean, under that reading, doesn't it incentivize the requester to then file a counterclaim? I mean, that doesn't seem to make sense. It's like increasing the litigation.
Perhaps, but I can also see a situation where a records requester does not want to get an attorney, and we differ, Ms. Marcus and the county differ in their position as to whether she was being sued. This was simply an issue where the clerk believed at the time the disclosure of the ballots would not be in the best interest of the public. That could have been ferreted out without any counterclaim and just a recognition that each party assumed their own costs and attorney's fees. I don't think it would mandate a filing of subsection 5.
But if they want attorneys, if they want to hire an attorney, well, you're almost saying you have to file a counterclaim.
You would, but then again, the cases that where Ms. Marks has done that and consolidated them, I don't see how it's adding substantially to the cost of the litigation. Those filings occurred rather quickly, the consolidation occurred rather quickly, and the case proceeded. So I don't see that as being a huge burden. And again, if that wasn't the intention of the legislature in subsection 6, then it should have specified a provision for attorney's fees in subsection 6.
Right.
And the points I wanted to make was the clerk's position is that House Bill 1036 did have some substantive changes in the law that addressed her concerns as to why she did not want to allow Ms. Marks to have free access to the ballots. Her request also stated that she wanted a member of the press with her to accompany her as she went through the ballots. There were some concerns with both that request as well as the request for a single, she did request a single unidentifiable ballot, but the clerk was concerned that what constitutes an unidentifiable ballot. How about a situation where there's only a handful of voters in a particular precinct, or one voter in a particular precinct voting a particular ballot style? That ballot, although not identifiable on its face, may be identifiable through reference to other documents. So those are the concerns that Ms. Marks, or Ms. Reno was worried about, and those were concerns that were addressed with House Bill 1036. There's actually some additions in 1036 that adopted a rule that if there's less than 10 voters on a particular ballot style, we don't have to turn those ballots over. So there were some substantive additions in 1036. Those are addressed in my those were addressed in our petition for cert. They're not addressed in minutes of the American Rule of Issue, but you can find those in the briefs on the petition for cert.
I suppose it just almost seems like a catch-22 or a gotcha kind of a thing. And you, somebody has filed a lawsuit, they say they don't have to turn it over, and you're entitled to file a motion, some judgment to dismiss, and then you settle the case, but then at the end of it, you're told under the statute that you never really were a part of this lawsuit, and therefore you can't get attorney's fees. That, why isn't that correct?
Well, what about a case where there's not necessarily any filing by the records requester, where they have done nothing to respond, and there's not a ruling by the court saying that they don't have to turn over the document? So in that case, you are awarding attorney's fees to someone who's had no contact with the case, really, at all. And so that's the danger of upholding the Court of Appeals.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
We want to thank both sides, of course, for their arguments. Ms. Davis, Mr. McGuire.